Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.
You're listening to The Dialogue with Diwa de Boer on Reality Check Radio, where we discuss politics, power, and culture. You can text us your thoughts on 2057 and email questions to inbox@realitycheck.radio. And I'm joined now by Dave Green, who vlogs as The Distributist on YouTube and Fiddler's Green on Substack. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Thanks for having me on.
And you're from the Pacific Coast, I believe, of the US and Canada. Are you in Canadian at the moment, or you're an American?
Yeah, I guess I am in Canada at the moment. I was born in Northern California, but I spent most of my life living in various places between Northern California and Canada. So anywhere around that region's my stomping grounds.
I guess that makes you familiar with the strange things that go on there, the kind of more obscure things that have worked their way into the public consciousness. So I'll just tell the story, I guess, of how I found your channel. And that was a friend sending me this video because he'd asked me, said, have you heard of Mencius mold bug? And I said, I had no idea what that is. So he sent me this video and it was titled A Gentle Introduction to Mencius mold bug. And I just had a look and I see it's got nearly 250,000 views. And I got into the video and I, who's this strange fellow and what exactly is a mold bug? Is that the video that where you sort of got popular in the sense where people started listening to this? Explained what neo-reactionary theory is?
Well, originally, I don't know, it's hard to say. That was actually pretty late into my YouTube career. I started in 2016 doing YouTube, largely as a response to try to carve out space between what were back then called anti-SJW YouTubers or liberalist YouTubers or skeptic YouTubers and the defunct movement that was called the alt-right. So I kind of wanted to critique both sides from a relatively intellectually serious perspective. And so a lot of my early videos were response videos in that genre, but I liked to touch on deeper themes. Then in 2019, I did a lot more explainer videos before the pandemic happened, and I took a brief hiatus. And that's where I made the Mencius mold bug video, which is one of my more popular videos. But the ideas of what's oftentimes called Italian elite theory, which is what Mencius mold bug or Curtis Yarvin became famous popularizing about almost 10 years before I made the video, it was actually more towards the early 2010s and or late 2000s. This is a school that I found very useful throughout my work and as a way of kind of rediscovering politics outside the lens of the 20th century, which I think has kind of stifled our ability to properly conceptualize what's going on politically. So oftentimes, most of what I write about is concerns directly what matters and what doesn't for creating lasting political change and being able to deal with politics as they are, which, you know, in this election season is kind of very relevant, I think.
And some of these ideas, if we jump forward to the present day, that Curtis Yarvin, who is the real name of this guy who was blogging as Mencius mold bug, and we know people who were influenced by his ideas like J.D. Vance are now running to be vice president. People like Elon Musk seem to be behaving in some way that Yarvin predicted or said that people would need to behave, kind of these CEO, sort of CEO philosopher kings. You can think of other people around the world who are trying to break out of the current paradigm by implementing these ideas that come from outside the frame.
You know, it's weird because part of this is a specific school that came out of Italy in the late 19th century, early 20th century. But another part of it is just rediscovering classical political realism. It's either discovering classical politics of the Aristotelian variety, or it's discovering sort of late Renaissance, early Enlightenment political realism of Machiavelli. This was, before the 19th century, the sort of default way of understanding politics. And so a lot of these thinkers, and I don't want, I mean, Curtis Yarvin, I believe, is brilliant in his ability to kind of map this on to current political structures. But the theory is not new. It's in many ways older than the leftist ideas it critiques, or even the liberal ideas it critiques. So I see this as more of a return to normal perceptions about politics and realistic perceptions about politics, rather than just the discovery of some like newfangled thing that just came out of the ether.
It seems to be framed as a new thing, or framed in the language of technology, of CEOs and so on, rather than talking about the kings and the aristocrats. We have PayPal mafia guys who made a lot of money in the tech industry, and it goes on to Elon Musk as well, and they are trying to behave in the way, I guess, of what a classic aristocrat may have done. Like Elon Musk is sort of trying to build a public town square, trying to build adventures, like rockets so that people can explore, like they used to go out on ships. You might have like a rich guy who would support ships that would go out and trade and with foreign countries, and a lot of that has been taken away from the world by technology, industrialization, and he kind of is like moving into the next level of going to the stars. Is that a good way of trying to explain some of these ideas to an audience that leans a little bit older as well? I don't quite know.
Well, I mean, there are very many different schools to this because it's an older school of thought. So there are people, a lot of the paleoconservatives, there is an author called Sam Frantz. So if you talk about people in the 20th century who tried to revitalize these ideas, the author that will come up most prominently is James Burnham, who is a elder statesman from the 50s and 60s. And was one of the people, I think, Orwell kind of tried to critique, who saw that governments in the 20th century were moving towards this mode of governments that he called managerialism. His book was The Managerial Revolution. His attempt to kind of bring about a reemergence of real politics was contained in a book called The Machiavellians. But you'll see many different branches of this. So there are people like Pat Buchanan and another author called Sam Francis, who these people were kicked out of the conservative movement in the 90s, that tried to apply these real political principles to things that were more classically conservative, or what we might call paleoconservative, conservatism before World War II. And then there are also latecomers like Yarvin and Nick Land, and an increasing number of them online, that want to take these reactionary principles and apply them to more future-looking perspectives, a sort of futurism. Futurism being a school of art from the early 20th century, and also a perspective that tries to map governments more onto technological developments. And I think that the second category I'm much less comfortable. I mean, I can tell you what they say, but a lot of it just seems like speculative and science fiction-y, and sometimes it's hyper-pessimistic. But I think the most important thing to internalize is just to kind of wake up from the political delusions that we're constantly being invited to occupy in the 20th century, we were invited to occupy in the late 20th century, and that we're still occupying in the early 21st century.
And if we look at some recent examples, then things that have been discussed in online and in the public sphere that have caused controversy. One of these has been around World War II and Winston Churchill with Tucker mm-hmm. Carlson, and his interview with martyr made Daryl Cooper. And mm-hmm. that caused a big firestorm because of, I guess, the implications to say, well, okay, if you're attacking Churchill, you're undermining the entire political system of World War II. Yeah. You were the one who put this, you wrote an article on your Substack basically saying that the reason this actually made conservatives so upset is because conservatives are used to being the beautiful losers. Like, we're used to the fact that we won World War II, we saved Western civilization, even though that kind of destroyed Western civilization. Like, it's like downhill from there, but it was the right thing to do. And so how do we move past this frame where conservatives are just losers?
If anybody saw what happened after World War II, who was standing in the late 19th century, they would have concluded that whoever won World War II wanted the swift abolition of the Western powers and Western civilization as it had existed. Because after World War II, there was a precipitous evaporation of the colonialist states. And it's not like these were just replaced with, you know, great, awesome governments throughout the what we now call the Third World. They were replaced with weird kind of client states, either client states that were clients of the Soviet Union or client states that were clients of the U.S. State Department. And this liberation of the Third World is one of many projects that were undertaken to sort of undo the old world as it was. Now, I'm a person who believes that the old world had a ton of flaws. By the old world, I mean the world before World War I and World War II. I believe it that that world did have a ton of flaws, and I don't want to romanticize that. But the what we're realizing right now is a lot of the notions that were used to ideologically drive this process are just not true and kind of futile. If you look how, for instance, a lot of the developments worked out in Africa in particular, you'll see how immediately they became problems, or how, you know, even how Asia worked out, right? Asia's deimperialization essentially just put it into a different power orbit, largely circulating around China and the Chinese Communist Party. This is essentially the narrative of the 20th century kind of coming undone. And I don't know how much you want me to get into the specifics, but it's more or less the thoughts here, I guess.
And we have a recent documentary as well from Matt Walsh that you've done a little bit of commentary on that as well. Matt Walsh asking, am I racist? Looking at the diversity, equity, and inclusion system. And just to give a brief explainer of, I guess, DEI is that it seems to be the product of liberalism. Like, sort of, it seems to be a natural way for the progressive system to move to.
Well, these are connected, right? Because the belief after World War One, and World War One is where the 20th century really started to be, or I mean, post-World War One is where the 20th century really started to kick off. After World War One, people believed, people like H.G. Wells and a bunch of other progressives, especially in England and the eastern coast of the United States, they believed that the source of all wars was essentially cultural and ethnic differences and the divisions between those differences, and that the key to world peace was essentially dissolving the distinctions and moving the world towards, you know, a completely diverse and equitable place. There's no evidence that guides this belief other than a fancy that occurred to people in the early 20th century. There are no philosophers that praise the virtue of diversity before the 20th century. This is manufactured by the priorities of governments in the 20th century to pursue this dream of essentially a deracinated world order that will be the key to achieving peace. And of course, I believe it's not. I believe it's just a disaster, because what happens is that these ideological differences, first of all, ethnic differences reemerge as ideological differences. And as opposed to being structured inside of country, outside of countries and between borders, the same problems occur inside countries. And you see this with a lot of the problems that Europe has had with recent mass migration. And this has also been a problem in places like Canada and the United States. The assumption that a peoples can just be demographically replaced with immigrants and then the system will operate in the exact same way has been shown to be fundamentally false again and again and again. It's false in Africa. It's false in Europe. It's false in North America. Now, once more, I mean, we live in a world that has necessary multicultural spaces, and there needs to be law and order in those places. But this cult around diversity, equity, and inclusion, this is the post-World War I vision of how we would solve all political problems by removing particularities between people. And it's based on a false understanding of human nature. Namely, that political conflict has to be introduced from without, and that political conflict is caused by ideology rather than it being caused by essentially fundamental realities about power.
And then conservatives and liberals, everyone after World War II, basically embraced this idea that we could all be equal in some way. And if not, the communists would want equality of outcomes, then conservatives would say, well, there's equality of opportunity. But that doesn't really seem to have manifested itself in...
I mean, equality of opportunity, how could you possibly... This is a good example of this kind of half lie that conservatives get suckered into. How can you have equality of opportunity if you have a child that's raised in a middle-class household and the parents take care of him and they read to him every day and they raise the child, and then he goes up in competition against somebody who has, you know, an abusive absentee father and then or maybe no family at all and has to be raised largely through institutions? The idea that these people compete on equal footing is nuts, just because there's no institutional advantage. And, you know, you could even if you somehow equalize that, which would be impossible, it would involve taking all children away from all parents. Even if you equalize that, then there are just differences that occur in between people because of the different distributions of genetics, both at the individual and group level. The idea that equality of opportunity is like this achievable, reasonable thing, and equality of outcome is this communist thing, the promise of equality writ large is impossible. So conservatives promising equality of opportunity are essentially promising people a bill of goods. And it really is a stepping stone to equality of outcome, because equality of outcome is the only way you can measure to see that equality of opportunity has actually been achieved. And progressives know this, which is why they love to play this game so much.
And to tie this into, I guess, what Matt Walsh is doing and what a lot of the conservative media are doing is making fun of DEI and asking the question, am I racist, and so on, and saying, well, we just want everybody to be treated the same. At some point, that requires sort of a rejection of the founding principle of the post-war era then.
Yeah, I mean, like, so what happens, right? Like, let's just get down to brass tacks here. I mean, there's just a de facto inequality between races in America that has been unable to be overcome, except with the most draconian policies imaginable, like literally moving kids around and stuff like that, which was, you know, hugely disruptive to communities and all this sort of stuff, or massive affirmative action. And even that doesn't fix the problem.
Just to explain this for the New Zealand audience a little bit more, sorry, I know this is called busing in America, right? Where they would literally just take kids and put them on buses and send them to a different part of the city or country to go to school.
Often, so
the schools would be more diverse.
To schools where they would be a racial minority. Which is, I mean, when you think about that, this was an incredibly unpopular policy. It meant like your kid is going to be bused across school so he can work in an environment that is going to be much, much more difficult for him to learn because it's violent. He's an outsider, blah, 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 blah. But this was the idea was, I mean, this was the only way to achieve a de facto integration. That was the only way that it could be done. And, you know, They got rid of it, and then we went back to this system where everyone just goes to their own schools, and then affirmative action comes in later and tries to rectify the problem at the last step. But that doesn't really work either. In order to keep that up, it involves this ever-expanding DEI bureaucracy to make sure that people don't notice that there are actual de facto differences between the two populations. But I mean, what is the conservative solution? To deny the difference exists? And to deny that the fundamental motivating difference in behavior exists between the two populations, and then promise that there's going to be an equality of consideration. And then when there's not an equality of outcome and people get angry at that, who do you blame? You just kind of toss it back in people's faces and go, c'est la vie. But that doesn't work because the promise initially was that if you got rid of segregation de jure, legal segregation as it existed in some parts of America up until the 60s. The idea was that the lack of segregation would immediately and imminently lead towards total integration of the various races and an emergence of a post-racial and post-ethnic society that was structured only around liberal egalitarian ideology. And that doesn't happen, and it can't happen for a lot of good reasons.
And how did you come down this path where I know that you grew up, I guess, in a more liberal background and so on. The essay that we referenced earlier from Curtis Yarvin is called A Letter to Open-Minded Progressives. There seems to be a lot of people who had a more liberal background or a more progressive background even coming to these realizations and saying to the kind of conservatives or people who are raised conservative, saying, well, actually, this idea that you have on how equality can be achieved is actually just not true.
Well, it's kind of like they have the old hand-me-downs of they keep on holding out these hopes that there's going to be like this moderating middle ground to this process, but it's never going to occur. I mean, here's a good example. I mean, there are a lot of Republicans now that are trying to talk themselves into this idea that by capturing 1 or 2% more on the Hispanic vote, they'll be able to sort of be politically irrelevant after the demographics are completely transformed in the United States. The Republicans tried this in California. This does not work. California is now a de facto one-party state. The problem is that the demographics, what you can call it different things. You can kind of read, you can kind of determine what you can kind of change the names, but the demographic patterns of the population absolutely determine, well, not absolutely determine, but they have a huge determinative component on how these groups behave ideologically and politically. And so the hope of the Republican Party to kind of create this, I mean, I do kind of believe in a multiracial ruling coalition, but their concept of it where, you know, through the magic of the simulation that Hispanics are going to become in their voting patterns identical to the various European white populations in America is totally fanciful and not supported by evidence. So a lot of this skepticism towards what on the internet you call normie conservatism comes from seeing how these sort of promised moderations never actually pan out. There's never like a concession you can make on sexual freedom that will satisfy the gay community. It's always the next thing. When I was in my mid to late 20s, I was very involved in the debate around gay marriage, first on the pro side and then more on the neutral side. But I remember there was one author I read, a writer from the Atlantic Monthly called Andrew Sullivan, who's an Englishman who is a big proponent of gay marriage and also was ostensibly a conservative. And his theory, it kind of sounds ridiculous to think about it, was if gays got marriage, if we actually gave them marriage, then gay people would be forced to become more bourgeoisie. And the gay rights apparatus that's focused on being kind of subversive and deconstructing sexual boundaries would turn around and then refocus its efforts on making sure that family life was better supported. that was his theory. That was his theory. And it was like, oh, if gays get married, then marriage will make gays more like heterosexuals and they'll start having Republican voting patterns. This is actually the opposite of what happened. When gay marriage became a fait accompli, what you see very gradually is, well, first of all, the LGBTQ activist apparatus that you see that's very, very well funded and is a huge power block in most urban areas, at least on the West Coast, they did not immediately turn their efforts to making sure that gay people had stable marriages that were free from divorce. They immediately turned their efforts back towards things like normalizing polyamory or the new transgender things. All of the gay money went, I mean, actually most of it went to the transgender insanity that's currently going on. There was no step back or moderation that was promised. And furthermore, insofar as marriage impacted the gay and straight communities, it was a portal for gay norms to come to straight communities. Certainly one of the most notable things that's happened inside dating and relationship, I don't know, I don't want to call them markets, but in the dating and relationship area of the culture in the past 6 years is Tinder. And what is Tinder? Tinder is a high-speed dating app where people essentially get quick matches based only on appearances. And there's an enormous number of matches and enormous incentive to hook up. Well, I mean, Tinder is a carryover from the gay community, an app that was called Grindr. And it worked very well for the gay community because it prioritized, large-scale anonymous sex. And that's and you see this, and that's not the only example. There's a variety of other things culturally. You see that the flow on the act of destruction, it always goes as a colonization process from the community that's less regulated and less ordered to the one that's more ordered. That is the continuous process. And all claims that there's going to be a moderating step, that's just going to come about because people wake up, those promises of moderation never materialize.
And we see this with the current transgender stuff, the transsexualism, the TERF movement. Like, the, you can see these people who get left behind as well then, like the trans radical exclusionary feminists. Said, well, we've got what we want. We can we stop now? And obviously, like, they get cut down.
Yeah, exactly.
The revolution has to carry on. The revolution moves on to the next thing. And then...
Yeah, I mean, this is... The TERF is literally yesterday's revolutionary. And I know that, you know, this is... So the TERFs stand for trans-exclusionary radical feminists. This is a constituency that the right has entertained kind of allying with because they're fundamentally against the current thing, which is transgenderism. But the problem is that their place in the right-wing coalition doesn't really make any sense. And they're kind of impossible to ally with. So I'm sorry, but that whole ideology of women having sex-specific rights and sex-specific privileges, that's just going to go the way of the dinosaur as last year's revolution, because it's incoherent. And it freezes the logic of revolutionary progressive liberalism in one place in history and then hopes that it will never advance forward, which never occurs, obviously.
And now for the harder part of this conversation, then, what are the solutions? Where do we go to from here? It's always easy to talk about problems, but I know you have been working a little bit on, you know, what do people do? What can people do in the real world or in the online world about these issues, and how do we align ourselves in such a way that we can actually make some changes?
Well, I mean, this classically, before I got onto the scene, when all of these ideas were kind of still on WordPress sites, the people thinking up solutions fell into one of three categories. And those were really the entryists, the accelerationists, and the parallelists. And so the entryist solution is, You change the solution by entering the system and trying to lobby for change within the system. The parallelist, which is the side that I'm most sympathetic to, is that you create separate systems, and the separate systems generate better utility and more utility for the people that they serve, and they start obtaining aspects of the government, and then at a later date, maybe become the government through an unspecified process. And then there are accelerationists that believe that change can only come through sort of a sudden change, and that the process of progressivism and technocratic progressivism needs to be accelerated so that we encounter that change sooner rather than later. Yarvin himself believes and lobbies for, although he'll never call it this, it is sort of a form of accelerationism. He believes that he wouldn't call it. I think he would. When we talk about accelerationism, usually we associate this with the thinker Nick Land, who is influenced by Yarvin. And it's quite a bit different than Yarvin's imagination here. But Curtis Yarvin believes that the way out of this process is for liberalism and democracy to kind of be wiped clean in one fell swoop by a Caesarean figure. And you know, he's sort of more broad-minded about what that would imply. He considers, say, for instance, Lincoln and FDR to be more or less Caesarean figures, but this figure would completely abolish the government and create a new government. And with that would also go the remnants of the 20th century ideology that was created and sustained by that government. I'm of the opinion that this accelerationism or monarchist or Caesarean option are kind of touch and go, and that the best thing to do is to kind of create parallel institutions. And I think the internet and the new techno landscape gives us the ability to make parallel organized societies and then use those as a mechanism for taking next steps, specifically in training new generations of leaders, which is something that our current system seems to be singularly incapable of doing. And, you know, I think entryism, I mean, everyone's doing a little bit of entryism, right? We all have our day jobs, but I don't know. I don't think that there are many ways to radically change the system by entering into it. You can't get promoted through a bureaucracy as being a person who wants to abolish that bureaucracy. And elected officials like Trump, I mean, there's a chance, but it would require a very, very young man to get elected and then suddenly get the, you know, get the entire apparatus of the American government on side and on board with the decision to abolish and remake itself, which is, you know, it's a tall order, to say the least.
Certainly, that would be the case. I can give you an example here of what we're working on here in New Zealand, because as you were talking, I was thinking of Reality Check Radio here, and this was founded by a movement called Voices for Freedom that came up during the pandemic here. And you probably heard in America and Canada about how oppressed New Zealand was under Jacinda Ardern's regime and the lockdowns and various authoritarian elements that actually sort of kicked off a parallel movement here, where you had these people who were disaffected and wanted to break free from mainstream media and form their own communities and have people that they could be in touch with, ways that you could work around the system. And it seems to have worked quite well in the last few years. I remember initially thinking, oh, this may just fizzle out and nothing may happen. But Voices for Freedom is still around, still actively campaigning, creating parallel structures. And then also, as you talked about entryism, things like there is an MP in Parliament who was elected on as part of our New Zealand First Party, and she's a member of this movement. And so like little bits and pieces were done along the way over the last few years to kind of create these communities who would meet in real life and do things together, put together our own media organization, start working on, you know, training figures to be politicians and encouraging people to get involved as well in the structure, entryism into the system, while having the kind of the lifeline back to parallel communities. So it does seem to work, in my experience, in real life, at least in a small country like New Zealand.
It is a tough order, though, because I think people oftentimes, when conservatives set off to genuinely break from the social norms that surround them, they oftentimes are immediately struck by how difficult it is. And this is something that I learned going from somebody who is very outspoken about things that ostensibly were minority positions like gay marriage and being against the Iraq War and being anti-George W. Bush in my early political consciousness, to being somebody who is very outspoken, being a right winger. And I mean, several things. First of all, it's way harder to be outspoken as a right winger. I mean, like, especially in the last 10 years, it's kind of calmed down recently. But you had this, like, people coming after you, people going after your identity, all this sort of stuff. It would burn relationships. It would burn opportunities. Tons of bridges were burnt with mainstream people. And, you know, that comes at a cost financially and socially to you. And furthermore, the other thing you realize is that it's much harder to organize as a right winger, because it's not really, you're not really aware of this when you're a left winger, of just how much of progressive activism is directly funded by the government. I mean, at least in America, like, every reasonably intelligent kid gets like 4 years of boot camp in an American university, where a huge, like, probably half the people working there are spend a majority of their time just advancing progressive causes. I'm actually kind of serious about this. The administrative staff spends, I would, an enormous amount of their time advancing progressive causes. And they're added in, they're all the departments that are 100% politicized. And there's a small fraction of them in the hard sciences that aren't. And not only that, the government just gives money to progressive organizations to organize, and has for, well, since the New Deal, been doing that. And so organizing is very, very difficult, and you have to constantly stop things from falling apart, because that's in real life, organizations are constantly falling into disrepair the second you look away. So it requires you to constantly feed effort and organization into these things so they keep on going on. And I think that the saving grace has been, at least to our most recent efforts, is that we've come up with we've been able to develop and find and unify a number of people who are very, very talented in their respective competencies. And those people's personality and their alliance and their dedication to ideologically moving forward has created a force that has been able to sustain continued organization for a long time. But it's going to be a struggle making sure that this survives from generation to generation, that this overcomes all of the changes that are on the horizon politically in the immediate next 5 years.
I can definitely see everything that you're talking about, sort of being part of a movement and realizing basically exactly what you've said that has to go into it, and moving the next generation into this way of thinking. And it seems to, small numbers now perhaps, but it does seem to be at some point inevitable where people just realize they have to break away from the mainstream system. But is fragmentation made easier as well by social media, perhaps? There seems to have been a lot of effort by governments put into crushing what they would call disinformation and misinformation. And it seems to be the new focus all around the world. Like the existing power structures realize that this is a threat. Yeah. You think, oh, yes, we're working our way around. We've scored a victory against the system. And then, of course, they move all of their vast power and resources to counter you.
Yeah, I mean, 2016, everyone just went insane because the social media definitively broke from the mainstream media and basically got Donald Trump elected. What's kind of crazy in hindsight is that we genuinely believed, I didn't believe this explicitly. If you'd asked me then, I would have said that I don't believe this, but a lot of people implicitly believed or talked themselves into believing that you could organize a revolution on social media platforms that were owned by your enemies. And almost everybody who kind of organized their lives around this strategy just got blown out of the water during 2020 when the government pulled out the big guns and just decided to ban everyone who was forwarding a narrative that they didn't like. And this is something that we have to take into account. I mean, social media gives the opportunity because it allows for spontaneous organization. But it's actually hard to make these social media sites do anything other than make people spend more time on the social media sites. It's very hard to take a population that's organized largely around consuming product on social media and getting them to actually do something in real life. And it's very, very difficult to get people who consume a product on a social media site, A, to then go over to a different one if someone gets banned. And of course, the algorithm will always determine who wins. If the algorithm starts favoring progressive voices, like I think it kind of did in 2020 and 2021, all of a sudden, progressivism will become a lot more popular. And so the problem here is we're kind of trying to reverse engineer the technology itself, I would say, is very conducive to our goals of organizing parallel systems of power outside of the mainstream. But the way that it's organized as being essentially owned by our enemies makes it so that you're essentially having to reverse engineer this functionality on a platform that fundamentally does not want to do that for you.
And just at the end here, since we're out of time, could you tell us a little bit more about where people can follow your work and also some maybe practical examples as well of concrete things that you're encouraging people to do in real life and the movements that you might be involved in, just to give people a bit of an idea of the kinds of things we're talking about?
Yeah. So there's a lot of things going on right now. Let's see. So if you want to find my work, obviously, or I'm not obviously, but my work can be found on YouTube. That's how I kind of got a little bit. That's how I kind of got my first small following. It's on the YouTube channel, The Distributist. I used to do video essays. Now I mostly do live streams. My essay content, though, is now found mostly on Substack. Every now I'm going to turn them into videos. And that's at fiddlersgreen@substack.com. And I always write under the name Dave Green. As for our organizations, or the organization, since I don't like I don't own all of them, the organizations I'm most involved in are almost all exclusively what I would call parallelist and pacifist groups, which means that they're focused on building non-threatening strength and non-threatening support networks that demonstrate an alternative, but try to only participate in politics along, very, very approved lines. It's very much a parallelist project in that mindset. And so some of the ones that I've been involved with, as a member, have been Kevin Dolan's The Exit Group, which is sort of a homesteading / professional development, business development organization. There is also an organization called Sildings that has a project called the Bask Weaving Project, which is a community building and meetup group, which we tend to encourage people to just meet up with people first to, kind of sort out people's different affinities for doing art or doing local politics or doing, health or literature or whatever. Then we have the Old Glory Club, which is an American organization that's sort of I call it a fraternal organization. It's really trying to replicate some of the energy that was classically done in those organizations like the Elks or, I don't want to say the Freemasons, but, the Elks or the Key Club or the Rotary Societies, the Odd Fellows. It's a fraternal organization that's supposed to be a mutual support organization. And then there are a myriad other publications, publishing houses, and conference organizers that are creating a scene for people who are working with art and with literature and with nonfiction. And of course, I only really contribute to the nonfiction and criticism dimension of that. So my involvement's a little bit more limited, but there's just tons of new publishers that have come out on that scene. So if you're interested in any of those projects, I think we have some stuff going on in New Zealand and Australia. So you can reach out to me and I can try to point you in the right direction.
Well, and we'll put some links in the replay description as well for those who are listening on replays.
And for contact, I'm most contactable through Twitter, which is, I think my name is GreenMan6 or something like that. I keep on deleting my accounts, but
Dave
Green, that's
on Twitter. You'll find him.
Unfortunately, I'm not great at getting back at on my email. And so it's much easier to get in contact with me with the stray DM on Twitter. So yes, that's it.
Well, thank you very much. And it's interesting to see a lot of the things that you were suggesting seem to have been things that have developed in New Zealand, not quite as sort of a what you would call dissident right or neo-reactionary right aspect, since we're a very small country, but more as part of what was kind of COVID protests. And there seem to have been a lot of connections made through that. And those of us in the who are thinking about political theory, right-wing political theory, a bit of a smaller faction there, but making connections and meeting people in real life who are fellow travelers on the road is very, very useful.
Absolutely. And I think that's what I would encourage the lessons of political realism, what I would encourage your listeners to think about is it's all about the network and the power that you can build yourself. The promises made by these institutions, I wouldn't be relying on them.
Well, thank you for that final word of advice. And that was Dave Green, everyone. And thank you, Dave, for joining us on the show. And to all of the listeners on the radio, stick around and we'll be back after this break.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to? Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057, or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you, so connect with us today.